Greetings, and welcome back to the podcast. This episode, we are joined by Mr. Eric Nuttall, partner and senior portfolio manager with Nine Point Partners and the Nine Point Energy Fund. The Nine Point Energy Fund is Canada's largest energy fund with approximately $2 billion under management. Mr. Eric Nuttall's views on energy are frequently sought after by BNN Bloomberg, CNBC, the Globe and Mail, the National Post, and other leading media organizations. Mr. Eric Nuttall graduated with high honors from Carleton University with an honors bachelor of international business. Among other things, we sat down to discuss the potential of a windfall tax on the energy sector, $50 billion in revenue and what it means for the Canadian economy, and why AI will require more Canadian energy. Enjoy. This episode is brought to you by Galatea Technologies. Galatea is a software company based in Calgary that is focused on helping producers better manage their fluid logistics. Galatea enables field operators and truck drivers with the ability to make the optimal decision on every waste, water, or clean oil load, resulting in 20% savings on trucking and disposal costs. The Galatea platform makes it easy to create digital truck tickets, manifests, and shipping documents that automatically flow through the field data capture and finance systems. Galatea's platform is used by over 50% of Canadian producers, 600 trucking companies, and hundreds of disposal locations. Visit GalateaTech.com to learn more about how to optimize that last line on your lease op. This episode is brought to you by Canada Action, whose belief is that the Canadian oil and natural gas industry is a force of good in the world, and that history will look back upon the sector favorably. Canadian energy plays a critical role in our society by reinforcing global energy security, underpinning Canadian economic prosperity, and setting the benchmark for environmental leadership. Get your free stickers at buildcanadaup.ca to show your support, or follow Canada Action on social media. This episode is brought to you by the Canadian Gas Association. The Canadian Gas Association represents Canada's natural gas delivery industry, whose members include distribution companies, transmission companies, equipment manufacturers, and other service providers. The Canadian Gas Association members deliver safe, reliable, and affordable natural gas to meet 38% of Canada's energy needs. Visit cga.ca to learn more about Canada's natural gas. Good morning, Mr. Eric Nuttall. Thank you very much for doing this.
Great to be with you.
I really appreciate your time. You are a fan favorite on this obscure but growing garage band of a podcast. So thank you very much.
You bet. I'm happy to see the traction that you're getting.
Thought we could structure the conversation in roughly two halves today, kind of a casual reflection on a few things. Everyone's always bugging you for your top picks, so we'll avoid that and then maybe into some current events. If that works for you.
You bet.
You started investing to make money in energy, but do you remember the time when you started to realize there were some high quality people in the industry and that it was a little bit more than just the money?
I think one of the biggest upsides of being a fund manager in this sector is you get to meet directly with many, many CEOs. You know, it's harder in the earlier days, much easier now because I've been doing this long enough and you get to know guys. And so just to be able to build a personal relationship with some CEOs and to recognize this sector is inundated with super sharp people, very hungry people, driven people, irrespective of astronomical levels of success. And you could be literally with a billionaire and you'd never know. Like if you didn't know them by name, you just saw them on the street by their behavior and how they act and such. So I love the humility, the humbleness, the intensity, the competitiveness that I get exposed to.
There's been a few guests on the podcast that I think may have nine figures behind their name and you'd never know.
Yeah.
So can definitely relate to that aspect. Do you remember your first energy investment?
My first? This is going back a long time ago. So we launched, I started working at Sprott Asset Management in 2003. We launched the Sprott Energy Fund in 2005. So I was working with Eric on that. That's now essentially evolved into the Nine Point Energy Fund because we did a buyout from Sprott in 2017. So it's the same fund, et cetera. I don't remember by name. I've got a lot of colorful memories, because Eric was a mining guy, wildly successful in mining. But to be successful in mining, you've got to have a different mindset than in oil and gas. You're more prone towards exploration. You're looking for the big, you know, hits, the one in 10, the one in 15s. So that took us to jurisdictions which most people would typically not want to go to. So whether it was like the North Sea, we had some good successes and then some not so good successes there. Colombia, and this is dating myself, but Colombia was a hot spot. So we had some huge exploration names there. But unfortunately, oil is an expensive commodity for a reason. It's difficult to find in good jurisdictions in economic quantities with takeaway capacity, et cetera. And so, you know, one in 10, if you own 10 names that have a one in 10, it doesn't mean that you're going to be successful. So it's shaped my philosophy now in terms of what we look for. So we, as an extension of that, we don't invest in exploration. It's just the risk to reward is not in your favor.
Don't remember the first name though.
I don't.
No, I don't. One of the 90s growth companies
too,
maybe.
Too long ago. You know, it may have been like a coal bed methane name, like Thunder Energy. But this, again, that's going back to 2004, 2005, give or take. So No, unfortunately, I don't.
And then somewhere along the way, you have the theme is growing momentum. You basically have a fan club now. Do you remember when that sort of started out?
I think it emerged out of COVID, because it's the great thing with oil and gas is we've all been through the most miserable experience you could possibly imagine. You know, it's almost like a movie, you know, in terms of just how horrific COVID was. And so when you're kind of the poster child of a sector that's just doing a complete face plant and you have no choice but to get through it, come out the other side, hopefully emerging better than how you entered, I think it was just the efforts that I put in to keep people in the trade, so to speak, and not capitulate when fear was just at its absolute highest. I just think that given that it was a small group that kind of engendered myself to those crazy people that wanted to stick with me through it. So yeah, it was fun. I haven't gotten to meet the gentleman who started it. I sent him a pen just as a thank you, because it's we've been through some great days. We've been through some awfully miserable, terrible days. So it's that camaraderie that I think is very, very special.
There's a lot of noise in the energy sector, the mistaking irrelevant info for essential. Do you see that a lot in the energy industry? And what would be an example to you of that, where you're just looking at the wrong thing?
Yeah. So that's a broad, broad question. It touches on a theme that I speak to a lot in presentations, not so much on BNN, because it's not really the platform for it, but on Twitter/X. And I call it energy ignorance, which I kind of define as the lack of knowledge of how oil or hydrocarbons are used, and the likely or even possible time frame to displace them, because we get inundated with noise on a daily basis by people that simply don't know what they're talking about. They have no clue about the realities of adoption behind, you know, EVs or the economics behind renewables. And so it's kind of a battle. And the reason why I battled against it is that that's been shaping sentiment in the wrong way. It's leading to extreme still pessimism towards the outlook for oil, even natural gas. You know, when you can have the IEA come out with not really a forecast, it's a scenario-based forecast saying the demand for oil and the demand for natural gas and even the demand for coal, which is just absolute stupidity, is going to peak by the end of this decade. And so an investor hears that and they say, well, geez, why the heck would I buy an energy stock? You know, why would I buy an oil company if we're not going to be using the stuff in 3, 4, 5 years' time? And then you have to start talking about stranded asset risk and all this absolute nonsense. And so energy ignorance feeds ultra levels of pessimism, which distorts what people are willing to pay for stocks, leading to now ongoing poor sentiment, which is wild to me because energy has been the only place to be for 4 or 5 years. Not an AI, I guess, but you know, energy's done so well. But I think people are just finally starting to see a lot of the realities, you know, policymakers recognizing that if they do really stupid things like Germany, you know, shut down your final nuclear reactor, like every environmentalist should be the biggest proponent of nuclear, but they don't. So they shut it down, they get hit with a cold spell, and they have to fire up their gas plants. Like, it's just epic levels of stupidity. And so you can start to see the cracks in energy ignorance as politicians/energy makers realize that poor decisions lead to energy scarcity and energy unaffordability, which impacts quality of living, which impacts their approval rates in the polls, which means, you know, job risk. So we're getting there. But yeah, you see energy ignorance on a daily basis.
The point of skin in the game is to feel the pain when things go wrong. Some founders along the way, they have success, and although they have money in their latest company, it doesn't equate to pain in the grand scheme of things when things go wrong. How do you think about that to make sure that people you're investing with actually, it hurts when things go wrong? Do you have to remind them to maybe put more money in sometimes?
I have in the past. Like, it's critically important to know that management is aligned with you and your clients, like your investors. So it is absolutely something that we look at. We track on a daily basis insider selling and insider buying. You know, insider selling, there's always an excuse, right? It's estate planning, or, you know, we're all paid in stock and whatnot. But insider buying, there's only one reason, and that is the CEO is confident in their business plan. They see the intrinsic value of what they're buying being much, much higher than what the market sees. The market's not seeing what they're seeing, et cetera. So we watch that as an indicator to give us confidence that we're on the right track. Whenever there is insider selling, we absolutely dig into every single situation for it to understand that. You know, it is understandable. Sometimes I see on Twitter, sometimes people, you know, wonder why CEOs don't buy more stock. And as somebody that lived through COVID with all of their investable assets in energy, which remains the case today, I can appreciate, given the volatility that we have, perhaps some portfolio diversification is probably kind of prudent. I'm not the best practicer of that, but we're looking for a CEO that if they screw up or they don't execute, that they feel it. That's critically important.
On the other hand, there are some CEOs in any industry or in energy that have all their net worth in the sector, even to this day, even though they have been wildly successful. And maybe there's a correlation.
I feel kinship towards them because that's, you know, my own philosophy is I should know names better than others. And when I look at the attractiveness of the sector relative to other subsectors, when we measure things on, like, free cash flow as an example, we would have the sector trading at a 13% free cash flow yield at $80 WTI, $12.50 WCS diff, $4 NYMEX and strip for foreign exchange. So I compare that to the market average, which is about 3.5% free cash flow yield, to me, which is wildly unattractive. We look at that. So I can appreciate why somebody would want to have exposure, you know, especially people that are running the companies that have direct, you know, say in terms of execution and M&A and strategic decision making.
The analogy from skiing is that when the sun's out and the snow looks good sometimes on the slope, it's a very dangerous time. If you'd apply that to the energy sector and investing, how do you think about the times when, although things are going well, perhaps valuations are where you think they should be and it's time to sell? How do you approach that subject?
You know, it's funny you say that because we've recently been raising a bit of cash, and we do so, there's a few reasons. You can get a sense of the levels of euphoria in the market. You know, when everybody's, when I get multiple interview requests asking me about my thoughts about $100 oil, that's a cause for concern. When you have everybody wanting to talk about the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, you know, is it, and what's going to mean, and oil's going to spike to 150, you can just get a sense in terms of whether people are optimistic or pessimistic. And to my core, I'm a contrarian. I learned that from my mentors. And so you want to be a seller, typically speaking, when euphoria is approaching its peak, but selling's really tough. You know, I think of buying. The best buys are the most obvious. They're usually the most uncomfortable. It's usually when there's panic, there's fear, you look like the biggest moron doing so, but you can get high quality assets at distressed pricing. Selling's tricky because it's emotions that are involved. It's innate in everybody. You want a top tick. You don't want to leave, you know, money on the table. You're thinking about, you know, market, not cost base, et cetera. So we try to be very, very disciplined in our selling. There was a name that we did incredibly well with recently that we bought off of a European supermajor in January 2021. Oil is at 53. We were bullish on oil. We saw a meaningful inflection of free cash flow potential. And the stock's gone from 18 cents to $5.30, roughly speaking. And so we made our clients about $214 million in that. Why did we sell? When we bought it, we thought risk versus reward was wildly in our favor. The current oil price then, it was fine. They could keep the lights on, but it wasn't glorious. But at $60, their free cash flow would go up 10x. Fast forward to today, even using $80 oil, $12.50 WCS diffs, et cetera, we've got it trading at 11% free cash flow yield. Our view was the sector would re-rate to 10% free cash flow yield. And so that offers maybe 10% upside. What's the downside? Well, this is a volatile sector, you know, euphoria, et cetera. Is it 30? Is it 40%? It's tough to say. So we really try to be disciplined in our selling, especially when things feel great, because I think energy investors today suffer from profound levels of PTSD. Anytime we have felt good, we have gotten run over. You know, and the past doesn't equal the future, but you want to be prudent at times when people are getting a little too ahead of themselves on either oil price or valuations. We really, really try to be as disciplined as we can, because my job as an energy fund manager is to provide the ride is like riding a roller coaster. And you want to maximize the ups and try to minimize the downs. It's incredibly hard to do that. We've done an okay job on the downside. We've done a very, very good job on the upside, but that's kind of something that we're trying to improve at every day.
Perhaps one unofficial proxy for market sentiment is interview requests.
When I'm getting called by the CBC to talk about, you know, $100 oil, it's like, okay, we're kind of there. So
maybe some current events?
Sure.
Windfall tax. You'd think that as maybe you were the largest or one of the largest energy fund managers in Canada, you'd be consulted about things like this.
You'd think. Yeah, no, this is the only government where I haven't met with the energy minister in recent history. And I'm not allowed to get too political in my public views. I have my own personal views, which are irrelevant. But I think there was, to my surprise, a very real risk in this last budget of windfall taxes. My understanding is it was being actively debated, and industry was successful enough at getting that item off the agenda. It baffles me. As we know, we're all biased in this, but this is a sector that's responsible for the highest paying jobs in the country. It's responsible for 15% direct indirect of Canadian GDP. As a country, we're in such a profoundly challenged fiscal state where, you know, public civil service, I think the employment is up 40% during the current government's reign, to be increasing capital gains taxes. And I'm biased in this because maybe subjected to it, but I think it further erodes our competitiveness as a country. And it's just taking us in the wrong direction profoundly. Typically, you know, governments, if they're pro-industry, they'll seek out advice. They may not agree with it, but they may seek out advice with an open mind and open ears. I think this government either doesn't seek out advice or they do so with closed ears and an open mouth.
To what degree do you rumors, at the very least, or actual implementation of those types of policies scare off capital in the country?
It absolutely does. You know, I got to meet with a gentleman whom I hope and the current polls show will be our next prime minister. Mm-hmm. And he found it quite amusing when I told him that Canadian energy stocks trade cheaper than US stocks owing to a political risk discount. He found that quite amusing. But it's true. You know, policies aimed at stifling production, sure, we'll say emissions, but it really is a production cap, are dangerous because capital is extremely mobile. We have to absolutely compete with jurisdictions around the world for investors' interest. Meaningful share buybacks is helping to offset the lack of interest, which I see on a daily basis in this sector. But bad policies lead to bad outcomes. And I remain very optimistic that in about a year and a bit time, we're going to have much, much better policies. And it's not to abandon, you know, environmental stewardship and such, but it's lunacy to me when people talk about, you know, the need to end dirty oil subsidies and we've got to increase our environmental stewardship. Like you think about TMX, the nonsense that we had to do, like we as taxpayers paid $50 million to move anthills and frogs out of harm's way. Like they found rare moss. This is in public filings. Like you'd think I was making it up. So like on Twitter, I put up a screen grab from the original primary documents because you'd think I was, you know, it was an April Fool's joke. But they found rare moss in the pipeline route. And so they hired people to come in and remove the moss by hand, put it in a secure storage facility, later to be put back by hand and such. And so how dare anybody say that Canada doesn't have the highest environmental standards in the world? And so to have a government attacking us based upon those false beliefs, where our oil sands are 0.1% of global CO2 emissions, Canada's roughly 1.4, the build out of coal plants in China, like you could nuke Canada and the world wouldn't even notice in terms of us attacking, you know, emissions and attacking a sector which is leading to, you know, massive transfer payments. But I could go on a much longer rant than that.
We're both slightly biased, but it's a fact. It's a fact that energy industry contributes billions of dollars to the Canadian economy. Meanwhile, debt goes up as well as spending. So at the end of the day, someone will have to pay for the bill.
Yeah, it's going to be $50 billion this year at $80 oil, over $50 billion in royalties and taxes, a lot of which gets sent out east where I reside. I'm in Ontario, but so
should
it's
be here.
I've tried with my wife, but just the tax differential alone, I think it's the winters. And then I've got three young kids, so uprooting them from their friends. Those are the two anchors that are keeping me in Toronto. But I always feel like I'm coming home whenever I come to back to Calgary.
Just a quick thank you to one of our sponsors, and we'll be right back to the show. This podcast episode is sponsored by Conate Water Solutions. Do you need cost-effective water sourcing options to supply your next drilling or completions program? Conate Water Solutions is a specialized hydrogeology company focused on water well drilling, testing, and water management services in Western Canada and Texas. Contact info at conatewater.com or check out conatewater.com for more details. Speaking of growth and rising revenues, LNG. How do you get exposure to LNG and how are you thinking about that?
Yeah, so LNG slash the gas trade is increasingly attractive. We have been the biggest, I would say, public bear on natural gas relative to oil for the past several years. And I think we've been proven to be right. Like oil names have outperformed gas this year is down 28, 29%. We know largely that's due to the winter that we had. You know, there was no heating demand storage today. I think Alberta storage is like 84, 85% full. Like it's, you know, we're 600 Bs higher than the five-year average in the US, et cetera. The bullish thesis clearly revolves around the increase in LNG capacity in Canada and the US. You know, finally Canada, we're going to have, it's intriguing to me. It took the US less time than it took Canada. Like, so the US landed a man on the moon faster than it took Canada to build the first LNG facility, but finally we're there in the next couple of months to quarters. So that's huge. And I'm getting increasingly optimistic that more projects off of the West Coast of Canada are going to get approved. They've got the power grid to kind of figure out. When you look to the US, you know, you've got current liquefaction capacity of about 14.5 Bs. That's roughly doubling between now and 2030. Plus, and I sound corny saying this because it's way too topical, but when you talk about artificial intelligence, you look at the power demand coming from that. And I've seen estimates, it's kind of all over the map, but by 2030, anywhere from 7 to 20 BCF a day incremental demand. Well, that's a 20% increase at the upper end of, you know, required natural gas supply. I'm sure it's not going to be a smooth ride. So you can see the structural bull thesis there. You have producers curtailing volumes, helping to restore imbalances. The challenge today, though, is I'm not the only person that sees that. The market sees that. And with natural gas down roughly 30% year to date, many natural gas names are up 20 to 25. You know, part of that is because oil is up and they have liquids, et cetera. But even dry gas guys have held up exceptionally well. So I tell my clients, like, we're out on the road for the next couple of weeks, and I say, you know, give me a dollar. I can go out and buy an oil stock discounting 65 to 70, strips 81. We use 80 in our decision making and spots 85. So I've got a big degree of safety. There's a big safety buffer there. Or I can buy a natural gas name with spot at roughly $1.50 and it's discounting $3 to $3.50. And while I may think it's going to go to $4, the risk to reward is not nearly as compelling. So we're trying to get our timing right. The attractiveness of gas over oil, it doesn't have as much ESG headwinds for investor interest, which is less significant, but still significant to global large institutional investors. So we're intrigued. We know the names that we want to own. It's just trying to get the timing right because I think shoulder season is going to be pretty vicious. Like we've got gas in, you know, Permian owing to bloated storage and inadequate takeaways trading at -$3, -$4 per MCF right now. You could see that potentially in Canada. And I just don't know if investors will, you know, if their stomachs will be quite as strong if we've got, you know, zero or negative gas pricing temporarily.
Speaking of AI and the requirements of energy demand, I think it was, if I'm correct, John Arnold. He was just named to the Facebook board, the trader for right. When you're naming a energy trader to the board of Facebook, there must be some reason for that.
You would think. So again, it shows you energy ignorance can only take you so far. Energy realities ultimately set in. Mm-hmm. And so you know, you can't have such a dramatic increase in power demand at a time when you're trying to decarbonize the grid, where it's we're going to run on solar and wind, and battery backups is simply absolutely unfeasible for a variety of reasons. And so it excites me for natural gas. It does excite me for nuclear. We've tried to our best to look at nuclear opportunities outside of just the commodity itself. And it's difficult to find adequate quality trading at more compelling valuations than oil or natural gas or service stocks, for that matter. So we haven't really gone there. By fund perspectives, we absolutely can. We can invest in coal or uranium alternatives, et cetera. But today, I would say we're finding the best opportunities still in oil, though it's getting a little more challenging. We see the long-term optionality in natural gas for sure, but names have held up. Services, where we find some themes that were attractive, some not so much.
Speaking of the disconnect between energy reality and the fact that demand is rising, oil will be around 100 million barrels, yet the valuations of energy companies aren't what they used to be. For example, they used to trade 100,000 flowing BOE, 120,000 flowing BOE. So I guess the question is, why?
Well, I'd say there's less investor capital available for sure. You know, ESG was thematic a couple of years ago, and a not so popular opinion would be it grew in popularity because it was a marketing tool used by banks and asset managers to try to differentiate their product, but then everybody adopted it. And then they recognized that it was a complete joke because there's no standardization in rules. And then you've got performance, poor performance. ESG funds did wildly underperform. And I kind of apply this, like I think everybody's an environmentalist until they have to pay for it. It's great if other people are going to do it, but when your quality of living, your standard of living starts to go down, then that's what matters. And you kind of apply that to the ESG narrative. So that is sapped some of the funds flows that could come back. When we think about, there's still this ignorance around the long-term role of oil, hydrocarbons in our life. And I think the primary reason for that is that the IEA, which is kind of the consensus for much of Wall Street in their modeling, has really lost their way. They were established in the 1970s after the oil embargo to supply governments with good data. And that's dwarfed into an evangelical, rapid decarbonization. And it's not just me saying this, like even Macron, the president of France, admitted, and Dan Tabucci highlighted this. He said in a speech, you know, the IEA has become an arm of ours to assist with, you know, the rapid transition, decarbonization, et cetera. And so to have chronic demand underestimation, and then you incrementally increasing it with each passing month, it really helps to negatively shape sentiment around the long-term role of oil. And then you come out with a forecast that, hey guys, by the way, oil demand is going to be peaking and it's going to be rapidly decline. Like it's just completely illogical. Like only the mathematically challenged could come up with that conclusion, but people read the headline. People have short attention spans. Not everybody's spending 24/7, you know, on energy or oil, et cetera. And so you see that headline, you're like, well, why the heck would I buy an energy company if demand's going to be peaking in a couple of years' time? So there's a number of reasons why valuations are not back to historical. We do think in some cases we are approaching fair value. Maybe we're being too conservative in terms of what that is. I always thought this sector would re-rate to a 10% free cash flow yield. And I thought this will be a low to no growth sector, maximizing free cash flow, ultimately returning 100% of that free cash flow back to shareholders, initially in share buybacks. And as you significantly shrink the shares outstanding, you get a re-rating because mathematically you have to ultimately. And then you shift from a buyer of your shares to a variable dividend model, which is not nearly as impactful as a share buyback. But when you're successful at achieving that share buyback and re-rating, you'll pivot. So I thought 10% was kind of the right number. There are some that are suggesting that that is too conservative. Maybe it should be 8, maybe it should be 7. Maybe it will be. I don't know. So we're going to have to see where the market takes things. So from a free cash flow yield, I would say some names are approaching fair value, like the generals, so to speak, the safe names where a generalist can easily get liquidity, they can deploy capital quickly, and then ultimately they can use that as a source of funds to buy other names. So we have yet to see money flow go down the market cap spectrum, which is kind of where we reside, because that's where we find the most profound opportunities where we can still see significant upside, because we don't really see it as much. There's exceptions to this, but as much in the large caps.
New York, there's more capital in the city, bigger capital pools. And that's where, for example, Riverstone is.
Right.
There is Canoe in Calgary, but why is there no Riverstone in Calgary?
Well, it's good that there isn't, because it makes the market that much more inefficient. And it's true. Like, if I ignore some of the smaller funds, which are either index huggers or they're ESG funds or clean funds or whatever, I only have one competitor. You know, it's Dave Zabunka at Canoe, and he's a great guy and he's a great competitor, but there's only two of us, because it's been a game of survivor for the past 12 plus years. And there's very few of us left. You know, most of the energy funds in Canada either got shut down, they became global resource funds, they became ESG funds, they became clean tech funds. And to a fund, their performance either, it doesn't exist because they don't, you know, they're not around anymore, or their performance has just been dreadful. So it's really Dave and I left. And what that means is this is an incredibly inefficient market. You have to be a little more creative. You've got to be willing to do the work. You know, we have every company largely in North America modeled between $60 and $100 oil. So it provides a compass to us to know, okay, where do we want to go dependent upon our macro views? Very few people will do that work, but it allows us to see what others do not see or aren't around to see. And it's a reason why our performance has been as good as it's been. Like my fund, you know, the biggest in Canada, which isn't saying much because there's only two of us, but it's the number one on a 3, 5, 10, and 15 year basis. Like we've doubled to tripled the index after fees on a 5 and 10 year basis. You know, it's not by chasing the generals. It's by finding opportunities where people aren't looking, or finding mispriced stocks and creating a catalyst that can drive a re-rating.
You just mentioned lots of capital available. Times you're considering going private or buying entire companies, maybe like Mr. Adam Walrus has done?
There was a time when, like, there was one oil sand name in particular, and it was the biggest standout to me. At current oil pricing then, it was trading at a 33% free cash flow yield. And you think of, okay, what is the risk that I'm taking on? You know, leverage a little. They've been deleveraging. So they'll ultimately hit their final debt target in a couple months' time, as an example, and they'll pivot to 100%. But you get 35 years of reserves, low risk, in my opinion, reserves, stay flat inventory. And at a 33% free cash flow yield, you can privatize in three. Their debt was equal to 1 year cash flow. So I was getting 31 years of reserves, i.e. free cash flow for free. And I was like, okay, like that seems rather compelling, because at $80 oil, they'd free cash the $1.2 billion a year. You're getting around $35 billion literally for nothing. So it was an example then. I couldn't, you know, the capital required to privatize that company, because you'd have to go to the board, you know, you'd have to clearly pay a premium. The capital wasn't available at the time. But there are way deep-pocketed investors. Like if I manage roughly $2.2 billion now, in the global scheme, you're a pauper, right? There's the scale of capital is just unbelievable. So I don't know if it was just ESG thematic. I don't know if it was the strip being backwardated sharply. And if you're going to privatize, typically they would want to hedge out a couple of years of oil to reduce the risk. I don't know if it was bank financing not being available for, you know, dirty oil, so, you know, so to speak. So I don't know. It reinforces the view. It confuses me sometimes. Why do more people not see what we see? Sometimes we're wrong. That's the reason. Most of the time it's been that just it's inefficient market. People are buying the BS of we're rapidly transitioning. This is a sunset industry. And that level of ignorance, again, going back to an earlier theme, I think is still providing some really, really exciting opportunities.
Especially during the pandemic, you could have bought the entire company.
It was awful. That was awful, awful, awful. Yeah, some people, some horrific memories, some good lessons coming out of that. But yeah, it's true. Like, you know, there was a liquids-rich Montney producer that my fund fell, and this is not bragging, it was horrific, but it was down 90%, over 90, I think it was 91% down at the very lows. Like it was just unimaginably horrible, right? Like you're not a going concern. You're not profitable at that point. You're hoping that your clients, you know, don't think you're a lunatic and stick with you at that point. Mm. But there was a liquids-rich Montney producer that fell to 14 cents. And I had a trade ordered, and I was about to hit the send button to buy 1 million shares at 14 cents. That stock today is $12.50. So it's just, it's unbelievable. And when we reflect back, you know, I was doing a video with a client or a Zoom to talk about the opportunities that we saw and such. And you know, we're watching oil go negative together as I'm doing a Zoom about, you know, how this too shall pass. Things are going to get better. So lots of crazy memories.
Do you see, because there's only one in Calgary, one in Toronto, do you see opportunity for other energy funds?
Well, I'm going to be biased in that opinion. I'm going to say no. I think the ability to launch a fund and raise capital when you've got two entrenched competitors who have both done a really good job, I think that's, we've got a very strong barrier to entry in that. And I'm extraordinarily biased in that. I do see US funds, like hedge fund pods, increasing in their interest level in Canada, increasing too. I think a big theme this year and going forward is that going to be, you know, US shale companies are experiencing negative rate of change while Canada is experiencing positive rate of change. US shale companies have an inventory challenge, broadly speaking. They have less of it, and the stuff that they have is getting less and less productive. It's getting gassier. Canada, we have decades worth of inventory. Our rate of change is positive because, generally speaking, efficiencies, productivity is improving in places like the Montney, the Duvernay, Clearwater. We have more and more takeaway capacity with TMX, with LNG Canada. So our pricing has a positive rate of change. And I believe that the ESG narrative is faltering. The recognition that this is not a sunset industry is growing. And so the value being placed on long-dated reserves should and is increasing. So that's to me very, very encouraging.
Couple questions from Twitter. That's okay. This one comes from Mr. Jamie Hurd, one of the sharpest guests.
Jamie's a great guy.
Yep. Yeah. Mr. McDonald is often a top 10 holder of his core ideas. How has his influential ownership stake changed investment style or philosophy as positions now carry both increased influence but also liquidity considerations?
It's a good question to ask. You know, when you go from, let's say, 100 million to 2 billion, you would think investment styles have to change. We really haven't changed that much. Like if you look at the composition of my fund, you know, admittedly we're sitting on about 33% cash at the moment, which is not meant to be a bearish stat. Like it's just taking our fund beta from 140% down to about 90, you know, short-term call. So we still have meaningful upside capture, we think. We continue to focus for now on the mid-cap space. Every fiber of my being makes me want to be contrarian, buying out of favor deep value names where we see catalysts that are there or we can create to drive a re-rating. You can't affect that with a large cap. Like you can meet, you know, with boards and the CEOs and we do regularly, but your influence is a lot less. So I'm really, really proud of, and I was but one voice in this, but I'm really proud of our role in shaping the narrative around the necessity to return meaningful free cash flow back to investors in the form of buybacks. I think that is really fast forwarded the re-rating in these names, and it's made the sector meaningfully more investable. So we haven't had to deviate. You know, you have to be a little more creative. It is true that, you know, if it was 10 years ago, I would have had 10 different actors to trade with, you know, and you can see that block volumes down, but then the number of investable names has fallen as well. So we're essentially full, I would say, in the names that we like. We showed our ability in a manner to exit a large position in, you know, a mid-cap name recently, and we didn't affect the bid or the price. So we can, yeah, we're pretty good at that. I think we haven't had to change. We're certainly not, you know, a large cap shop just because our AUM has grown, and it allows us, Jamie points out, we do so in a very respectful manner, but we actively present to boards our views, and we're but one voice. But when you own 9.9% of a company, you hope and you think that they're going to listen to you in terms of just our philosophy. And that is, energy investors broadly, my clients specifically, have endured the worst bear market in history. And it is now our time to be rewarded for that patience. And we're going to get paid in the form of buybacks that are going to drive a re-rating still in these names that are trading well below what we think they should be. And the surest path to achieving that is meaningful buybacks. And so chasing production growth is a poor decision when you can go buy your own inventory at depressed pricing. And so, yeah, we haven't had to change our stripes. We haven't had to change our style just because our AUM has grown.
Another question from Twitter. Recent appearances, Mr. Eric Donald suggested scale is more critical than ever for energy companies to be relevant to the general investor and attraction of capital flows. What brought about this evolution in thinking, and what do you think it means for Canadian engineers going forward?
Yeah, it may sound like I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth when I say, you know, we really like the mid caps because that's where the value is, but you know, you got to get bigger to gain scale and such. I recognize the contrast in that. You have to appreciate this is a market where capital flows are negative, sentiment is negative. There are very few players, i.e. energy funds, we've touched on that. And that leads to inefficiencies. But when a generalist institution is going to be long, you know, I can't get stock specific, but it's very clear what they own. They all own one specific name that has done very well. You know, if they're feeling really risky, maybe they'll go, you know, buy the next oil sand name. They're not going down the market cap spectrum. And so, yes, I can see that, you know, meaningful share buybacks financed out of free cash flow is enough to drive the re-rating. And that's true. But to achieve the end result that much faster, it's helpful if you're more attractive to those larger pools of capital. So I always tell boards, like, your biggest challenge, how do you get on that list? How do you get on that list of investable names when everybody's in the same name right now? And so part of it, liquidity matters. You know, we'll typically have minimum position sizes, about 3%. I prefer larger sizes than that, but 3% roughly on 2 billion. Well, that's a 60 million position. We can't own more than 10% of a company. It's 600 million market cap minimum. And I'm a weird guy where I like to buy small caps. I'm the exception. So I am a believer that scale, i.e. market cap, will increase the odds of getting on that list of being investable to larger institutions because you alleviate the liquidity concern. But you can't do that if by merging with somebody, you're getting worse. That would be idiocy. So there are some examples in Canada, like if you're in the same play, for example, where there's strong synergies, there's strong overlays, maybe you can upgrade a board or a management or whatever the case may be, where you can emerge from that situation better and have the benefit of bigger market cap, bigger scale, bigger relevance. That just increases the likelihood of getting that multiple expansion versus just, you know, sticking it out, buying back your shares, and you're getting smaller than that. So I recognize I am talking out of both sides of my mouth on that topic, but I think, you know, meaningful share buybacks is the surest path, but scale and meaningful buybacks is that much higher confidence of achieving a multiple re-rate.
Some of the best management teams in Calgary and Canada have been around the block, so to speak, and they basically run private companies now and don't necessarily need the capital. You are one of the largest funds in Canada and probably know all those guys. Do you consider going in the private routes with those types of operators?
Yeah, I've really been tempted. There's one specifically, a large Clearwater name, which is kind of obvious who that is. And I borderline begged them at a conference held in this town in January because we were very keen on having a new name. And it's such an exceptional company. But as a mutual fund, it is such a headache to own private companies from a compliance perspective. Like, yes, there's an active gray market, so getting marks in your valuation, but just, you know, fund mandates often limit you to 10% in restricted securities, your liquid securities. So you've got that. You've got to, on a monthly basis, make a case for what the mark is on valuation. It's just the compliance headaches make it extremely unattractive to hold privates. So if you can find as compelling opportunities in the public space, it really negates the interest in going into privates. I fully recognize that when you hit it in a private, you can hit it just completely out of the park. I recognize that, you know, often a private company can do things more strategically because they don't have to worry about a share price that goes up and down on a daily basis. They can deal with an overhang and, you know, you can do M&A, which makes long-term strategic sense, which in the short term may impair your stock price. So I see that, but it's such a pain in the behind. I strongly prefer not to own privates.
When you're looking at management teams, some would say what you're looking for is a technical team, geologist, engineer, ideally from Saskatchewan or a small town to lead your energy company. Do you look at it that way? What do you look for in management teams?
It's really subjective. Like, the benefit of having done this for long enough, I've made enough mistakes to gain wisdom to know that you never, almost never, want to buy opportunities where you don't have an extremely strong feeling. And it's just a gut feeling. I think I've mentioned this before, but there have been examples in the past where you meet with somebody and you have an innate feeling that you need to go take a shower. So it's that gut feeling versus, you know, history usually rhymes And those who have had success in the past usually will achieve that. I mean, you see there's certain names in this city where they've just done so spectacularly well time after time after time. And yeah, there's screw-ups along the way, but generally speaking. So if I can find it a team with skin in the game, has history on its side, where I trust them implicitly, ideally we can get to know each other on a social level, because ideally you want to do business with friends. My analyst, who's a geologist, meet their technical teams. Like, he was just in the field in Houston now meeting with the technical team of one of our large holdings to corroborate our view on the quality of acreage that they bought a year ago, that kind of thing. So it's very subjective, but those are kind of the qualities. Somebody that you trust, ideally somebody that you like, with skin in the game, with a history of success.
Well, it is April 18th, 2024. To wrap things up, message to energy investors out there, what would you leave them with as of today? Calgary, it's
sunny. We remain bullish. And we're not a permabull. You know, strategically, we're a little defensive currently. Just, it feels like there's a little bit of euphoria in the oil market. You know, again, I'm getting too many invitations to talk about $100 oil, et cetera, and the CBC calling and all those kinds of things. So it's a really short-term thing. And we're paid by our clients to be active, to be tactical, et cetera. But you look out 3-5 years, you've got a sector where this is not a sunset industry. We'll be using hydrocarbons for the rest of our lifetimes. Energy ignorance is leading to insufficient investment. You've got non-OPEC, non-US production peaking in the next 3-4 years. US shale growth, very clearly at the rate of growth, is slowing down. And so we still see growth this year and next, but at meaningfully less. And you have OPEC, where the biggest mistake people are making is saying, well, geez, they've got all this spare capacity. They're forgetting who holds it. That's even more important. Who is more important than the quantum of it? And it's my impression that the holder of that is unwilling to bring that production on until they're a little more confident in the outlook of the global economy, that they achieve, you know, reduced volatility that can allow for eventual investment, and ultimately a budget-friendly price for them, which is a little higher than we trade today. So we think, you know, oil, $80 floor, that's what we use in decision-making. We're optimistic on natural gas. And so long as you can go into the realm of, you know, mid-cap land where people, largely speaking, are not looking, we're still finding some really exciting opportunities. And I think one of the biggest opportunities available that people are not thinking about is the compounding impact of meaningful share buybacks. You know, as somebody that can do the modeling, can look out a couple of years, the multiple compression achieved through 10, 15, 20% share buybacks is wild. So as good as this sector has been in regards to share price performance, even at a static oil price, that compounding impact alone, I think, is the next leg of driving real meaningful upside. And it's very clear that people aren't there yet. So while it's been a good place to be the past couple of years, not so great in prior years, it is cyclical, there'll be up years, down years, et cetera. We remain bullish on the outlook of the sector, because you've got, I can't think of another opportunity where sentiment is so poor broadly, in Canada, in the US, globally. So sentiment is poor. Fundamentals are so strong. Like, literally, we've never consumed more oil today than we have in the history of humanity. Global oil inventories, you know, typically last year they grew by 100 million barrels from January until now. Well, they've only grown by 10 when you measure inventories divided by demand. So you get days of supply. We said that reaching a record low this summer, which is supportive of about a $90 Brent price. And then we've got geopolitical risk premium, which I hate to have to talk about. It's probably reasonable to have something in the oil price. And you have a sector with their strongest balance sheets in history, not pursuing growth, maximizing free cash flow, committed to returning that back. Finally, we've all been disappointed in the timeline on this, but finally reaching their final debt targets and about to return 75, even 100% of that back to us. And so the best days are still not behind us there. We still remain bullish on the outlook.
Awesome. Well, we can end the formal conversation there. Thank you.
You bet. Happy to spend the time with you.
Hello, listeners out there. Thanks for checking out the podcast. Hopefully the episode provided some insights. If you enjoyed the show, check out trose.ca, where more episodes are yet to come. You can also subscribe to the podcast, where your token of support is much appreciated. Until next time, happy coffee drinking.